The Natural Nurse with Ellen Kamai and Dr. Z, Mondays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, listeners, to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, naturopathic physician and your host for this day's program. We're really excited to have Dr. George Fletchus on. Dr. Fletchus is a medical doctor and has his master's in public health. He majored in physics at Southern Missionary College in Tennessee, and he got his doctorate in medicine and MPH from Loma Linda University in California. He's the medical director of Fletcher's Family Practice in Henderson, North Carolina. He specializes in hormonal therapy for the treatment of fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, and other types of specialties, particularly iodine therapy for hypothyroidism and fibrocystic breast disease. I met Dr. Fletcher as he was lecturing at a conference which I lectured at, the Restorative Medicine Conference, and I was intrigued by his lecture and impressed by his wonderful ability to bring technical information to the audience and make it very clear and understanding and clinically practical of how we can help these many folks that kind of fall between the cracks, people diagnosed with fibromyalgia. So, without further ado, Dr. Fletcher, are you there?
Yes, sir, I sure am.
Oh, great to have you on the program. We met in Moab. What a great place, huh?
Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah, and it was wonderful to hear you and connect with you. I know you came to my arthritis lectures and whatnot, and we shared quite a bit of information at the conference there. Wonderful experience. But let's talk a little bit about what you actually do and how you fell into this whole type of diagnostic information and particularly therapeutics using iodine, because I'm sure you didn't learn about that in medical school.
No, actually, when I was working at my master's in public health, I was going to specialize in international public health. And one of the things they taught us to do was to go into a population, look at the illnesses there, and see what would be the simplest thing to do to help resolve the issues that are present within that population. In my particular case, I've been in family practice for probably 20 years, and I noticed that the incidence of breast cancer had been climbing and climbing in the population. And one thing I noticed, too, was the problem of fibrocystic breast disease. And back in the late 1990s, there was an article in the Journal for the American Medical Association that pretty much pointed out that one of the major finds in, or new changes in medicine was that they had discovered that an iodine deficiency was probably felt to be the source of breast cancer and also the source of fibrocystic breast disease, which at that point was affecting about 94% of the females in the nation. And at that time, I sat there and said, wait a minute, from a public health standpoint, we've been putting iodine in the salt. And the iodine should have been taking care of all of these problems, quote, of iodine deficiency. So then I started looking around in there, and I found out, number one, that 50% of the women in America cook with salt that has no iodine in it. We had been taking the iodine out of the bread. We took the iodine out of the milk. And the last place that we still have iodine added is in the salt. And even now, the American Medical Association is pushing that over the next 10 years, we need to, quote, decrease the intake of salt in the population by one half. Well, if this is the last bastion for getting iodine, what's going to happen is that we're going to get, you know, we're going to cut in half the amount of iodine that the population is getting. Now, the problem is that for years we have known that iodine deficiency in a population will produce a problem known as cretinism. And cretins are basically human beings that are created in the uterus and then later on in life who are iodine deficient. And iodine is very crucial towards development of normal brain function. And we find that no iodine in the water, the food, the so on, you get problems with severe mental retardation, otherwise known as cretins. Mm-hmm. Well, recently the Italians published a paper showing about 5 years ago that the absence of iodine in early pregnancy is felt to be the source of attention deficit disorder. They looked at children up in Tuscany of Italy, and they found that they followed 20 children who were followed over a 10-year time period, and of the 20 children, 11 developed problems with attention deficit disorder, and many of these kids had problems. There was not very much iodine in the Tuscany area. In fact, there's a lot of goiter up in the Tuscany area. Mm-hmm. Flip side of the coin is that the children who were raised along the coastline where the mothers ate a lot of fish and seafood and so on, out of 20 children that were being followed, zero of the children were diagnosed as having attention deficit disorder by age 10, as compared to 11 out of 20 by age 10 up in the Tuscany area. Which made me interested into how much, what happens if you take a population and you give them a lot of iodine? And there we would talk about the Japanese and the Koreans, and we find that these people eat lots and lots of seaweed. I mean, we're talking seaweed three times a day, seaweed and the gummy bears, seaweed and the saltine crackers and so on and so on.
Yeah.
And here in the United States, among the population, the ethnic groups that have the highest IQs in the United States, it's the Japanese and the Koreans who eat lots of seaweed as they do back in the old country. Mm. And what happens is that there was a really nice article by the American Thyroid Association just published within the last few months, showing the relationship between iodine and fetal development and fetal life. And there's good papers that have now been published showing that if you give a baby while it's still a fetus inside of its mother iodine, that the iodine will help to increase the IQ of the baby at least 20 to 30 points.
So these are all things that we, like epigenetic things that we can do to influence the genes by saturating, for lack of a better term, the body with iodine.
Right, especially as a fetus. And we can influence the next generation by producing children that are 20 to 30 points higher than what they are right now.
And that's
all we have to do is just give them iodine.
What's its relationship to breast cancer? I find that, you know, very fascinating because, you know, we've been kind of taught that it's related to estrogens building up in the tissue and and usually I know in holistic medicine we look for the more toxic estrogen metabolites that can build up in the tissue. We call those the 14 and 4 hydroxy things, and also maybe pollution and xenoestrogen. So where does iodine fit in this complicated picture?
You know, it happened right there in New York State, up towards the Great Lakes region. We noticed 100 years ago that there was a big epidemic of hypothyroidism and goiter up in the Great Lakes region. We're talking Buffalo, Akron, Detroit, Milwaukee, Chicago, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it turns out that when they looked at the incidence of cancer among the people who had goiter, the number one cancer that popped up was breast cancer. And other cancers include that of thyroid cancer, ovarian cancer, endometrial cancer, stomach cancer, and esophageal cancer. Mm. And it turns out that the absence of iodine in the human body is a promoter of cancer. And there's been some studies done by Dr. Bernard Eskin from down here in Philadelphia at Drexel University. And he just published a few years ago showing that iodine inhibits the ability of the body to make estrogen. And when you don't have enough iodine, the body tends to make a lot more estrogen, and hence the more problems that we see with estrogen dominance in the body, such as being overweight, having problems with increased cancer, etc. So, and they also noticed that estrogen inhibits the ability of the body to absorb iodine. So in Akron, Ohio, 1924, they noticed that among children with goiter, that the rate of goiter was like 1 to 1, one little boy to one little girl. As soon as the girls went through puberty and started developing estrogen, that the girls, the rate of goiter went from 1 to 6, one boy to 6 girls having goiters.
Wow.
And it would be later on that we would find out that estrogen inhibits the ability of the body to absorb iodine, and hence the increased goiter incidence in little girls. But take that down a few years now, and now you've got the problem called hypothyroidism. And you'll notice in the United States that the incidence of hypothyroidism is like 9 women to every 1 man.
Yeah, definitely.
And the problem is that in the current medical endocrinology people, they tend to think that everything that's hypothyroid is due to autoimmune thyroid disease, when it could be that the probably a good majority of these people are low thyroid because they don't have enough iodine. Mm. If you don't have iodine, you can't make thyroid hormone.
So, how would our listeners assess their iodine in the body? Are there any good ways that you use in your practice to assess the amount of iodine? I mean, you've painted a great picture for certainly assessing this thing. I don't know of any health panel or test, random health screening test, when people come in, you know, go to the doctor for their yearly physical, quote unquote.
Yeah.
I don't see the doctors checking for iodine. I know I do, but you're the guest, so why don't you tell the listeners about how you would go about it?
Yeah, we developed a test that pretty much looks at how deficient is the body. And in this particular case, what happens is that the human body can hold 1,500 milligrams of iodine. The thyroid by itself only holds 50 milligrams of iodine. And we in medicine have a tendency to pay a lot of attention to the thyroid,
right,
and totally forget what else is going on inside the body with regards to iodine. Now, what's interesting is that we give 50 milligrams of iodine to the human body, and then we watch and see how much is urinated back out over a 24-hour period. Like, I just had a girl a few years ago who submitted a sample. This is a 17-year-old, and we gave her 50 milligrams of iodine, and over a 24-hour period, she urinated back out 1 milligram of the total 50. She literally absorbed just about all the iodine we gave her. And I called up her dad, who was a physician, and I said, look, you know, your daughter is behaving as if she were a dried-up sponge.
Right.
She drank that whole 50 milligrams of iodine and hardly peed any of it back out. At which point, I told him, I said, you know, one of the problems of iodine is that the absence of iodine in the human body is a precursor for cancer. And I said, you need to look at, you know, this girl, your daughter, and find out if, you know, have somebody check her out, do a good thorough thyroid check and do whatever. But I said, it's just not common to have somebody this deficient. And he called me up about 2 weeks later, and he said, we found a thyroid cancer in my daughter's neck.
Wow.
And he said, you were right. You know, the absence of iodine is a precursor for development of a cancer. Now, in this case, we give 50 milligrams of iodine, and then we watch and see how much comes back out. And let's say you absorbed 20 milligrams. I mean, you urinate 30 milligrams out, you absorb 20, and so on. So it's right. Kind of a subtraction method to figure out how hungry is the body for iodine. So we developed a laboratory, and it's here in Flat Rock, North Carolina. It's called FFP Laboratories. And we use this lab as a method to try to figure out when a person is very low in iodine.
What's your website? Just while I'm thinking about it, what's your web? I like to throw that out a couple times.
Yeah, my website is called helpmythyroid.com.
Great, so people can get more information.
Yeah, so if they want more information, they just go to helpmythyroid.com, and that should give you a lot of information, and also articles that we published on the subject of iodine deficiency and human health.
Yeah, I reviewed that very extensively. Let's talk about the thyroid a little bit. I mean, we do spend a lot of attention on it, and I think we need to mention it, and then I want to talk about all the other organs that iodine plays a role. It seems to be very concentrated in many organs, like the ovaries and other things, but why is thyroid issues, why are they not properly diagnosed by your medical comrades? They're basically relying on some of the thyroid blood work, but that doesn't seem to catch many patients with thyroid issues. I mean, it catches some, but there's other thyroid conditions that exist out there that kind of leak through the cracks, so to speak.
Right. What we have found is that when you take you add iodine to the body, the thyroid likes to pick up the iodine. What's happening is that one of the biggest misnomers in American medicine is the fact that we sit there and say, well, there's plenty of iodine in the salt, therefore, we don't have to worry about the thyroid. And the problem is that we've got two problems. Number one, 50% of women are not cooking with iodized salt. Hmm. Number two, many of the fast food companies are not using iodized salt when they make their different foods. And number three is that iodine has a nasty little habit of turning from a crystal into a gas and basically never goes into a liquid. Having said that, let's say you put some iodized salt into your salt shaker and it takes you 2 or 3 months to get through all the salt in that particular salt shaker before you replenish it.
Right.
The problem with that is that the iodine that's in that salt shaker and even in the open container of salt will slowly evaporate into the air. It goes from a crystal straight into a gas.
Mm.
And what ends up happening is that you may start out with 77 micrograms of iodine per teaspoon of salt, but at the end of 3 months, when you go back and check the amount of iodine in that salt, it may be down to 10 micrograms per teaspoon. So that the total amount of iodine dropped precipitously over the last 3 months, and you just didn't know it. You thought that, well, once the iodine is captured in the salt as a crystal, it's not going to go anywhere. And what we're finding is that that's not true. It disappears.
Makes sense. It is a halogen like chlorine and other
and bromide and
which,
fluoride and
right,
so on. So
right.
It's in that same family.
Right, yeah.
So these are unique, these halogens are unique structures in the sense that they can go from a crystal straight into a gas without having to go into the liquid form.
And I know that was one factor that you hammered in when I saw you at the MOAB conference, Restorative Medicine Conference. You basically were talking about the influx of bromine in our food, and of course fluoride too,
yeah.
And how that also can displace the amount of iodine in the body and create, occupy the receptors, and that of course can play a big role in many of these pathologies that rely on iodine to keep them at bay.
Yeah, in fact, let me just give you an interesting article. I found this one on a subject that they did in China. They took a group of people who were already marginally living on iodine in China. This was in a certain valley. And they took those people and they fluoridated the water of that particular country. Of that particular section of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Within 5 years, they noticed that the number of babies that were born as cretins and were developing as cretins more than tripled just because they, quote, fluoridated the water. In other words, these people had just a little bit of iodine, were just making it, and so on. But the moment they started adding fluoride, all of a sudden the fluoride competed with the iodine, and you ended up with an increase in mental retardation in that whole area. Now, in the United States, we're down to a section here where we are depleting our population of iodine, and then we add fluoridated water to that system. We're going to end up with a lot of, increased retardation that occurs in the population over the next few years. Problem is, most American doctors don't even recognize what a cretin looks like when they see them.
Mm.
And so that's going to become a real problem. The other problem is called bromide.
Yeah.
My son was one of my original test subjects because I was giving him iodine to see how much would come out in his urine. And when he brought me back his jug of urine, he had like a half an inch to a full inch of brown sludge at the bottom of his jug. I sat there and said, what in the world is this stuff? So I had it tested by Dr. Abraham in Southern California, and he came back and said, your son is loaded with bromide. If normal bromide levels is 0 to 12, my son's bromide level was 600. And I said, this is not right. There's something really wrong here. Where are you getting this bromide from? And, he said, I don't know. So I said, well, show me where you go eat. And he said, well, let's start off at Taco Bell. And I said, Taco what? And he said, well, Dad, the fifth food group of America is Taco Bell.
So yeah.
I said, okay. So we went down to Taco Bell, and I looked and looked, and I said, I don't see anything here that would be high bromide, I said, what do you drink? He said, oh, I drink Mountain Dew. I said, which one of these cups do you drink it from? He said, oh, the biggest one. He said, and I drink two of those every day. So I thought, wow. So I went back and I looked at the issue called bromism. You can look it up on the internet or any type of medical dictionary. And it basically says that people with bromism have problems with increased bromide toxicity, which can cause problems with acute paranoid schizophrenia, problems with hypotesticular function, can cause problems with abdominal pain, bad breath, severe acne, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I said, show me, do you get any of this Mountain Dew at school? He said, oh, sure. So we went over to the school and looked at the commons area. There was 12 vending machines at that school. Two of the vending machines were dispensing milk, water, juices, Coca-Cola, et cetera. But out of the 12 vending machines, 10 dispensed nothing but Mountain Dew, and we're talking 3 and 4 times a day the machines had to be reloaded because they were being depleted that fast by the kids at that school. And the problem is that the higher the level of bromide that gets into the bloodstream, the higher the risk of the population developing problems with acute paranoid schizophrenia. To tell you how significant this is, back many years ago, before the development of Alka-Seltzer, there was a thing called Bromo-Seltzer.
Right, exactly.
And this was from 1920 through 1960. People were taking Bromo-Seltzer for hangover headaches, etc. The Bromo-Seltzer was, you know, there are medical studies from the New England Journal of Medicine and other journals showing that Bromo-Seltzer, back between 1920 and 1960, was responsible for over 20% of all acute paranoid schizophrenic admissions to psychiatric hospitals nationwide. And
wow.
That says Bromo-Seltzer all by itself. And it turns out that the bromide was taken out of the Bromo-Seltzer, and that's how we went on to develop Alka-Seltzer. But in 1964, we have a new product introduced on the market that's loaded with bromide, except now it's called Mountain Dew.
Huh.
And now they've started taking the bromide out of just the Mountain Dew, and now they put it into Fresca. They put it into the citrus-flavored Gatorade.
Oh.
And they're putting it into all sorts of drinks. You need to look for it. It's called brominated vegetable oil. You'll see this on the side of the label, and that lets you know that there's bromide in there. In
is it
fact,
a preservative, or is it a preservative, Dr. Fletcher?
It helps to disperse the oil of the citrus flavor into the fluid.
Oh, I see.
Now, the problem is that was said for the oil, but you know what? About 5 years ago, there was an article on National Public Radio where in England they had a massive recall by Coca-Cola because Coca-Cola was putting an ingredient into their grape sodas that were being sold all over England. And what was the name of the product? Brominated vegetable oil. And the thing is that a lot of this, you know, the bromide was being placed into grape, you know, soda. And the Coca-Cola company didn't think they had to tell the public that this stuff was in there.
Isn't it in white flour, too, and like bleached flour? Like anytime you eat a muffin, a commercial muffin, or go to the big donut places around the country, whatnot, they're using white flour and it's brominated?
Yes, and in fact, many years ago they started introducing, we used to put iodine into the flour, and then we took the iodine out, and then we started adding bromide. And bromide is a toxic substance that is something that comes out of the oil industry, the petroleum industry. And bromide is used to as a toxin. And in fact, the bromide industry, or the petroleum industry, has had a hard way getting rid of this stuff. And so one of the things they did was they added it to bread. What's interesting is that you can now get bread that contains no bromide in it. And a lot of health food stores try to make sure that whenever whole wheat bread is sold at the store that it contains no bromide. It's interesting that the Brazilians, back in the year 2000, Brazil took all the bromide out of any flour and said, we do not want this substance in our flour or breads in anywhere in the nation. What's interesting is that a few years later, the Canadian government went and did the same thing. They took all the bromide out of their flour. But we in America continue to have the bromide in the flour, even though this stuff is a known carcinogen. I mean, you can look it up. The studies were done by the Czechoslovakians showing that when bromide is put into the body, it gets absorbed just like iodine, except that iodine is good for the body and bromide is a toxin.
Right. Just like
and not only a toxin, it's a carcinogen to the thyroid. And within the last 10 years, the incidence of thyroid cancer has been climbing and climbing and climbing. And we're all sitting there saying, well, where is this problem coming from? And it turns out it's from the bromide that we've been sticking in the population through the bread and through the soda drinks and so on and so on.
Well, let's take a quick break. Get a cup of tea. Everybody out there, don't drink that soda with the bromide, though. Be careful. And we'll be back in a few minutes with more natural alternatives with Dr. George Fletcher talking about iodine, the thyroid, and its many myriad applications in the body. Don't touch that dial, folks. Stay tuned.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, this is Dr. Mayor Eisenstein. Every Thursday morning, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, I will be coming to you live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I will bring my background as a physician and as an attorney to help you with a minimal pharmaceutical and a minimal surgical approach to your medical issues. Please come join me.
So to join in on the conversation, call 888-874-4888. Ask Dr. Eisenstein, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, only on Progressive Radio Network.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
Hello. Check out my show, The Animal Magnet Pet Radio, live every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern on Progressive Radio Network. Or catch it anytime you like by scrolling through the archives. You'll hear me, Deborah Wolf, best-selling author and award-winning radio host, chatting with the best pet experts and animal A-listers in the world about controversial topics like breed bans, the indoor versus outdoor cat debate, and whatever else is hot in the news and on their minds that matters to animals and the people who love them. Plus, we tell pet jokes, we'll give you trivia and smart, quirky facts, recipes, and take-home tricks and tests, homework your pets will love. Email your pet problems to me and we'll solve them on air. So listen to The Animal Magnet on Progressive Radio Network and get your animal fix.
Freedom News Hour will bring you up to date on the latest news on the financial meltdown.
Begin restoring local communities. It can happen.
We'll be exploring the issues from a freedom-oriented, small government perspective.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster.
I am Jake Towne.
Join us live Thursday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
South of the border.
Hello, I'm Johnny Mueller, and I have a brand new show called The Expat Files, and it's all about living, working, playing, or retiring in Latin America. I know what it's like to buy land, build a house, start a business. I've been through it in a dozen Latin countries. So, if you're thinking about moving down, or you're just curious, be sure to listen in, Mondays and Wednesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Down Mexico way.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Yes. Bye-bye.
Okay, we're back with more of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamprone, naturopathic physician, professor at the University of Bridgeport, and your host for this program. And we have Dr. George Fletcher, who's a medical doctor and has his master's of public health, and he's an expert in treating fibromyalgia, which we're going to talk about, and other types of illnesses. He's been practicing since the late 80s, and we're talking a lot today about iodine therapy for hypothyroidism, breast diseases, cancer protection, helping the brain of the fetus, and so many things. And certainly you can read more about Dr. Fletcher's information on his website, helpmythyroid.com. Welcome back, Dr. Fletcher.
Oh, you're welcome.
Great. Let's talk a little bit about, we talked about the bromine and things like that. That's fascinating how that kind of has been inundating people and probably displacing, most likely displacing the iodine there. But let's talk about the, yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, let's talk about the different other organs that you said. You said the thyroid only has a certain percentage of iodine stored in it. Where else is it stored?
Well, it turns out that the 20% of all the iodine in the human body is in the skin. Lack of iodine, the skin can't sweat. And so you'll see people in the summertime who get real hot, but they can't sweat.
Is that
the best
right?
The best story I have on that is a lady down in Puerto Rico that I met, and she a few years later died, and I spoke to her son, and he told me the story. He said, you know, 5 years ago, my mother told me that she couldn't sweat anymore. She was 70 years old. So she said, son, you need to look up why I can't sweat. And this guy's a pharmacist, you know. So then he said, mommy, you don't need to sweat. You know, if you sweat, you get stinky. And she said, son, you're crazy. The education has gone to your brain. She says, we live in Puerto Rico. It's 90 degrees out there with 100% humidity. I have lived on this island for 70 years. I am used to sweating. Don't tell me not sweating is normal. So, you know, so for the next year, you know, every year for the next 5 years, she kept asking him on her birthday, have you figured out why I can't sweat? And he said, no, it's okay. You don't need to sweat. You know, you don't want to get stinky. Well, she finally came down with metastatic breast cancer, and within a period of 6 months, she was dead from the breast cancer. And the thing is that the absence of sweating tells you that there's not enough iodine in the body, and that right there is a major statement, because the absence of iodine in the body is a precursor for the body to develop cancer.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I thought that, I mean, I remember studying with Dr. Bill Ray, who's a, you know, detoxification expert in Texas, saying that when people don't sweat, they're often chemically toxic. But that might be true,
well,
because they might be bromine toxic.
They might be loaded with bromine, but but frankly, they don't have iodine. And if you don't have iodine, you will come down with cancer. It's just a matter of time. You're sitting there with a time bomb in your hands. The other thing is that that's 20% of all the iodine in the body sits inside the skin. 32% of the iodine sits inside the muscles. Now look at this. Here's iodine deficiency in the thyroid. You get cysts, nodules, scar tissue, enlargement, and we call it a goiter. And, you know, and now there's another organ that competes against the thyroid as far as who's going to get the iodine, and it's the breast tissue. Lack of iodine to the breast, you get cysts, nodules, scar tissue, enlargement, and now we add to that pain, and we call that fibrocystic breast disease. Cyclic breast pain just before a menstrual cycle. The other tissue, you know, the thyroid makes thyroid hormone, but what's the other tissue in the human body that can make thyroid hormone? And that is the human ovary. Ovaries can absorb huge amounts of iodine. Well, it turns out that lack of iodine to the ovary, you get cyst, nodules, scar tissue, enlargement, pain. And we call that polycystic ovarian syndrome, or PCOS. And we know for a fact that women with PCOS, by the time they get to become into their late 40s, early 50s, have a very high incidence of ovarian cancer.
Yes.
In fact, many gynecologists recommend that a woman who has PCOS, by the time she's in her late 40s, early 50s, should consider to have the ovaries removed, because the incidence of ovarian cancer is so high. Now, here we have the muscles. 32% of all the iodine in the human body sits inside the muscles. what disease do you know of that contains, as part of its complex, cyst, nodules, scar tissue, enlargement, and pain as part of the total picture?
Fibromyalgia.
Fibromyalgia.
Wow.
Is that simple?
Yeah, it's very logical.
And the thing is that in fibromyalgia, there's no increased cyst in the muscles, but there is the nodules, the pain, the swelling, the scar tissue. It's all there.
I've actually seen some cysts, and it's interesting, in the Chinese philosophy, which I'm also a practitioner of Chinese medicine, they do recommend, you know, see vegetables. Of course, they were using the ancient therapies back then. Sargasso is one of the things they call it from, I guess, the sargasso seaweed and whatnot. But, yeah, they were talking about that causes stagnation of the chi and blood and the formation of a cyst, actually, in the muscle. So that's kind of interesting that you put those things together.
Yeah.
So one-third of the iodine is in the muscles?
32% is in the muscle. And it was one of our patients with fibrocystic breast disease who pointed out, and she said, you know, doc, every time I take the iodine to get rid of my breast pain, she said, my muscle pain disappears. And she said, if I don't take the iodine and if the muscle pain comes back, all my whole body muscles ache and hurt too. So I touched her tender points of the fibromyalgia disease. And she sat there and said, you know, those are the exact places where my muscles hurt when my breasts are painful. And it was the tender points of fibromyalgia. So I said, well, let's just do a study here. And why don't we just give you, you know, I'm going to control whether you get real material or if you get a placebo. And I said, only I will know which one's which, and you'll be the one that tells me if I gave you the real McCoy or not. So, and when I gave her the placebo, the muscle pain would stay, not go away. She said, my breast pain is here, my muscle pain is here, you gave me placebo. And when I'd give her the iodine would take away the breast pain almost within 30, 40 hours.
Wow.
But what's interesting is the muscle pain always disappeared. You know, I think that fibromyalgia, part of it, I won't say that all of it, but at least part of the picture of fibromyalgia is iodine deficiency of the muscles. And that when you replace the iodine in the muscles, the problem will disappear as far as the pain is concerned.
Well, that's certainly worth a therapeutic trial in many of my patients, that's for sure.
I mean, this would be a simple...
I even have some guys that have fibromyalgia, and it's interesting that you pointed out the estrogen connection, too, because it seems like as they got older and their testosterone to estrogen ratio kind of changed and they got, you know, a little beer belly, and we know that, you know, the more fat you're carrying, the higher the estradiol in a man.
Yeah.
And now they're getting muscle pain. Now they attribute it to getting old, but maybe that's not true.
That's right. And the thing is that, you know, even as men are getting older, they're making more and more estrogen. What better way to treat them than to give them iodine? If you think about it, look at this. You know, for people above age 60, hypothyroidism is responsible for at least 25 to 30% of the population becoming senile.
Wow.
And if you give these people iodine, they will not, you know, we can just giving them iodine and keeping their thyroid functioning and making thyroid hormone, we can knock out at least 25 to 30% of the senility that's in the population right now.
Wow. Now, once I gave a patient iodine, I think too much, because they developed kind of almost like an angioedema based on the iodine, and maybe they took too much or developed some type of a sensitivity. So some folks could become allergic to iodine. Let's talk about the downside of iodine? Is there any downside of the iodine therapy that you should be monitoring? As it, you know, of course, people listening here, I don't want them to try this without really consulting with their holistic doctor or whatnot, or certainly maybe they can get in touch with Dr. Fletcher's here. But what are some cautions that we can, you know, balance the conversation with here?
We've had quite a few people who sat there and said, you know, I'm allergic to IVP dye, and therefore I'm allergic to iodine.
Yeah.
When you take iodine and you combine it with a protein, you totally make a totally different product, which people can become allergic to, and that would be the IVP dye, et cetera, and used in radiology.
Right.
Or even the protein of a crustacean,
shrimp,
crab, et cetera. The protein of a crustacean plus iodine, you get something that is people can have allergic reactions to. But in checking with the population at large, we find that the vast majority of people who say they are allergic to, let's say, IVP dye, they can sit there and eat iodized salt. And it's the people who break out in hives when they eat iodized salt. Those are the people you got to worry about.
Okay, okay.
But, and so I just keep some iodized salt in my office.
Yeah.
And I just take some of the salt and I put it in my hand, let them lick it, or put it in their hand and let them lick it. And watching, and then just have them sit there and let me watch them for the next 10 or 15 minutes. If they don't break out in hives, then I know we can use the iodine for those people. But, and it turns out that that particular number is probably 0.5%. It's a very, very, very rare reaction where people are actually allergic to the iodine, period.
Mm-hmm.
They're allergic to iodine plus a protein, but not to the very iodine itself, which is the type of iodine we use to replace, to give people replacement therapy with.
Now, what about getting getting this from seaweed, eating more Japanese style food? What would be your healthier ways?
I think that would be wonderful if we were used to it. Frankly, you know, you and I
like it.
You and I in medicine have been pushing our patients towards eating more organic, eating more vegetarian.
Absolutely.
You know, don't go around killing Bambi, et cetera, et cetera. And the problem is that we forgot to teach the population how to cook marine vegetarianism. That is, we haven't taught the people how to eat seaweed.
Right.
There's like 22, 23 different seaweeds out there. The Japanese eat seaweed three times a day.
Wow.
They eat it for breakfast. They have it for lunch. They have it for supper. And, you know, when you get to the point where you're eating seaweed three times a day, the Japanese eat on average 13.8 milligrams of iodine a day. The average American eats around 140 to 150 micrograms of iodine. We here in America eat about 1/100th the amount of iodine that they do in Japan. Now, in turn, because of the high intake of iodine in Japan, the Japanese women have some of the lowest rates of breast cancer in the whole world. And in fact, those populations of women who eat lots of seafood, such as the women in Iceland and the women in Japan and Korea and so on, they have the least amount of breast cancers as compared to the rest of the world.
Yeah, and I like the sea vegetables because, you know, sometimes the predatory fish are polluted with mercury and things like that. So I like the sea vegetables. You know, it's interesting. I have Irish heritage, and they always would make their puddings out of carrageenan and Irish moss. That was a big, that was considered a tonic by the Irish people. And same thing in the West Indies. I know traveling around the West Indies quite a bit with my students, studying. Again, people that live on the coast there tend to be the healthiest of the population there, consuming fish from the sea, and again, Irish moss being a nutritive tonic?
Well, that's just it. You know, we need to teach the people how to take and add seaweed. Like, let's say you add seaweed to your rice to give it a little bit of flavor,
right,
maybe some greenery. We need to add seaweed to our stews. We need
yes.
to add seaweed to our vegetable soups.
Yes.
We need
I
to
use
add...
it as a thickener. I use it as a thickener, like when I'm doing non-egg-based cooking, like, say, I'm making pancakes or baking
nope.
or whatnot. I'll use the carrageenan or some of those other things. I'll cook it up or agar-agar flakes. I'll dissolve it in a little bit of
right.
apple juice and make like a little bit of a mucilaginous substance to hold the recipes together instead of
you
using egg whites.
And the other thing is that, you know, we have, a lot of us like to eat scrambled eggs.
Yeah.
And we like to, and we think we're doing healthy by adding spinach to our scrambled eggs. Well, whatever, you know, what would it hurt to, instead of adding spinach, we add seaweed?
A little kelp there, sure.
Some kelp. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, because when you look at some of the nutritional books and they're looking for the highest sources of nutrients across the board, the sea vegetables, including even potassium, like everyone, I always trick my patients. I say, what's the highest source of potassium? Of course, everyone says bananas, and I say, wrong. Seaweed is much higher if you can figure out a way to use it. Just a dash of pulverized kelp or fucus. Or dulse.
You got it.
Could certainly be helpful.
You got it. So yeah. It's an issue of having a, you know, having some ideas about where can you stick seaweed. The other thing is a lot of stores, health food stores, will allow you to taste the, you know, where they have a, they serve food at
like
the health
food
store.
Like a provender or something like that.
They
yeah.
will allow you to taste different types of seaweed. So you can taste these seaweeds and then decide which ones you like, because they each have their own individual flavor.
Mm.
And then you can start adding that to your foods. And, you know, that's one of the biggest problems I see in American dietary, is the fact that we are teaching our people to eat more and more natural, eat more and more organic. And the problem is we forgot to teach them how to eat sea vegetables.
Very good point. Very good point.
I mean, it's a public health issue.
Yeah, and certainly with your expertise in that, we could see. And so it's beyond goiter, beyond looking at these things. And, you know, I meant to ask you, when did they decide as a public health measure to iodinize salt? That seemed like a smart thing back in the old days. But
well, that would happen with Dr. Marino in Akron, Ohio, back in 1924.
Okay.
When they did the studies on children, and
right.
they were looking at goiter. You know, in Akron, the incidence of goiter was 56% of the population had a goiter.
And what would people notice, like, listening now? What types of things would lead them to think they had a goiter?
Well, there would be a thickening at the base of the neck. There would be difficulty with swallowing. They would feel like there's a lump there when they swallow.
Mm.
They would notice that their shirts are getting tighter around the collar, that things are just not feeling right in there, and that's part of the problem of goiter. Mm. And the other thing is we're seeing a lot of thyroid nodules now, and so we need to do more to pick up on these nodules as far as what's out there. I mean, there's probably per million people in the population, there's probably about a good number of goiters that are sitting out there, and the incidence just keeps going up and up and up in the population as we subtract out more and more of the iodine out of the American dietary.
Now, if people have thyroid issues, should they go ahead and take the iodine, or should they? Is it okay if you have a goiter to take the iodine? Because I've heard that iodine can help both hypo or hyperthyroid. Maybe in the last few minutes you can give us some advice on that.
Well, you know, I got caught with that one a few years ago. I had a lawyer that came in here, and he had a neck that was a size 28.
Wow.
He had a massive goiter, and he said, I don't want to go through surgery. I want to have, you know, I want to take iodine. And I said, well, we'll try. So we gave him iodine. He came back 3 months later. His neck had shrunk from a size 28 down to a size 24. Hmm. His thyroid T4 went from a 7.5 to a 14.9. He walked in with a very fast heart rate.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat there and said, you know, I bet you haven't been sleeping well. He said, no. He said, I'm having insomnia. And what happened is that you put a lot of iodine into a massive goiter, and that goiter is going to start making massive amounts of thyroid hormone.
Okay.
He lost about 30 pounds in 3 months, but it was because he became hyperthyroid from a gland that was putting out huge amounts of thyroid hormone, which is why if somebody does have a goiter, they should take it under the guidance of a physician.
Okay.
If they want to take iodine, only because there is the potential that the individual could develop problems with hyperthyroidism, and then you got real trouble on your hands.
Right. Well, give out at the end of our program here, I think we got a minute left, Dr. Fletcher, really appreciate your words of wisdom. I learned a tremendous amount just listening to you. It's just fascinating. I remember talking about this with Dr. Jonathan Wright many years ago when I went to school at Bastyr, but boy, did I forget a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for setting it straight with the issue. So your website is helpmythyroid.com.
Yes.
And can folks, if they live far away, can they send you some labs and maybe you can talk them through
work? Yeah, the medical board of North Carolina won't let us be making diagnosis of patients unless they're seen physically.
Okay, so they have to come down there.
Show me lab work, they got to come here and be seen in North Carolina.
Makes sense. It makes
sense. But because, you know, so often you got to see a person, you got to put the hands on the thyroid.
Yes, of course.
You got to see what's going on, because otherwise you might get caught with a situation that you wish you'd never touched, you know.
Exactly. So, well, anyway, they can certainly read your articles on the website, and we really appreciate you coming on, and I'd like to invite you on again to talk more about it. Bye-bye.
Sounds great. Thanks
a lot, Dr. Fletcher.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. And that does it for another edition, folks. Stay healthy out there. Bye-bye.